Hello, colorful cast of characters. It is
Hi.
And Marcy. And guess what? We just did this like pretty dope collab with your favorite book by Melavika Prasad, and it was a really dope episode. We did Giovanni's Room. And Malavika is a laugh. She's hilarious. Typically on her show, she asks people what their favorite book is and they talk and discuss about it and just like have a good time. So we did Giovanni's Room because honestly, Marcy really loves that book and I had never read it before.
Yes. And as folks who, I mean, we have not done James Baldwin yet, but hint, hint, that might be coming sooner than you think. Yeah, I was really glad to get the chance to really sit down and talk about this book because I read it actually about a year ago and like, I texted a friend about it and we were like geeking out about it, but I didn't have like an actual out loud conversation with anyone about it. So it was really cathartic to just like sit down with the two of you and just like have that conversation. And Malavika is just great. And honestly, the picture of like just what it should look like to collaborate with another podcast, to like curate interviews, to like just bring in guests. You know, we don't have to pay her compliments with self-deprecation, but, you know, certainly some things I think we can learn a little bit from her form and like kind of how she brings together that space. Because sometimes we just have guests and we like, look, we'll just see what happens. Like, we'll just turn on mics and see what happens. But but it was really, really dope. Really enjoyed the space. Definitely enjoyed the chance to talk to you all. And honestly, it was a really great conversation. So
yeah, I loved
check
it.
Check her out. Support her.
I don't think I'd read Giovanni's Room before, so it was really, I loved it. And yeah, like echoing everything Marcy said, Malavika is just dope. And you're right, she curates her show in a way that's really impressive. So totally check her out.
Yeah. So now let's get into our episode. Woo!
Hey, I'm Akko.
And I'm Marcy.
And welcome to the Colored Pages Book Club. That's right. It's a bi-weekly podcast. And it focuses on fiction, fantasy, and magical realism.
Absolutely. Yes.
Written by writers from colorful backgrounds. You know what this sounds like when your aunties at church? And they're like, say it again. Say it again.
One more time. Yes. Yes. Correct. I don't know what that was. We love to see it, however. Yes, indeed, to the colorful background. And yeah. It's good to be on the mic again. I know y'all can't tell this because y'all get the episodes every 2 weeks, but like Akko and I, we haven't actually recorded the show
in a little bit.
We did this a lot. How the fuck did we do it the whole time? Because I feel like I've never done a show before, but here we are in the future.
Right. We're looking at our microphones and there's cobwebs, and you're like, huh? Interesting. But speaking of cobwebs, but not really, today we are reading a steampunk, light fantasy sci-fi, historical fiction novel set in the 20th century Egypt, and it's called Master of the Djinn by Djeli Clark.
Yes. You're super. First of all, I'm like, is that how transitions work? It's like, speaking of whatever, it's just saying whatever the fuck. After. Love that for us. And yes, I am super excited to talk about this book. So I know I have this whole thing, and we'll talk about this, but like, you know, I have this whole thing of like, I mean, like, I like fantasy, but like, do I, you know? And I feel like this book is really, I'm like, okay, I can fuck with the fantasy because this was a bop. This is definitely a bop. I'm super excited to talk about it.
Yeah, it's exciting. I also think that this one is not, this is not high fantasy. So it's not like a Stone Sky, Lord of the Rings type situation. It's historical fiction kind of place in a time and setting. Anyway, we'll get into it. Before we do that, though, here is a little about the author. Oh, look at that one. Smooth. Okay. Fenderson Djeli Clark, born in New York, raised in mostly in Houston, Texas, and he spent most of his formative years going back to his parents' homeland of Trinidad and Tobago. Also, I've never heard anyone say Trinidad or Tobago or just Tobago without Trinidad. It's always Trinidad, Tobago. Anyway, I don't have any thoughts about that except for it rolls off the tongue real smooth-like, so keep at it, you know?
Yeah, That is interesting. I've also noticed that too. It was never just Tibby.
You know what? Somehow, some way, and I don't have any right to say this, I'm a blame colonialism. I don't know why. I don't know how, but I feel like it maybe was probably one place that maybe got cut into two places. Everyone's like, Akko, you can't just be making up stories about things. You're right. So speaking of people who make up stories, though, the Jelly Clark has spent most of his life writing speculative fiction. And when he's not doing that, he actually works as an academic historian whose research spans comparative slavery and emancipation in the Atlantic world. So I think he's talking
about... Wow, fuck it up.
I know, right? You know who could answer that question about Trinidad and Tobago? The Jelly Clark.
Absolutely.
And he loves to meld this interest in history and the social world with speculative fiction, which is what we have here. Mm-hmm. He's written articles on issues ranging from racism and H.P. Lovecraft to critiques of George Schuller's Black Empire. He does panels. He does lectures and workshops. Also, I know, right? He also thinks Han shot first, which for all my Star Wars nerds out there, I agree is accurate. So that's basic. Everything else made him legitimate, but this is why we're reading the book. So
right, no, I mean, honestly, as a Star Wars expert, I can only agree, because you know, Han definitely shot first over the other party, who honestly so irrelevant we don't even need to name them.
Oh,
because it's just so clear that Han shot first, because who else would have shot first if not Han? Can I get a name in? Okay, thank you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I was having a conversation with someone about Harry Potter the other day, and it was a similar level of tomfoolery. Marcia and I neither of us have read the books. And so we mostly spent 10 years of the first half of the 21st century just being like, Malfoy, Voldemort. Yes.
Hufflepuff. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes. Slytherin. Yes, yes, yes.
The boy who lived.
Were there four? It was Hufflepuff, Slytherin,
Gryffindor,
and Ravenclaw.
Yes,
osmosis. Yes,
cultural
we love to see it.
Osmosis. Speaking of cultural osmosis, Marcy, I have a cultural context.
Oh, love that. Let's hear it. Let's hear the cultural context.
Yes. So this book is set in early 20th century Egypt, particularly the year 1912, which is sandwiched in between a really interesting time in Egyptian history. And this is a speculative fiction novel, so it actually takes a different timeline approach to the story. But to understand that timeline, I think it's important that we understand Egyptian history. And also, I think we need to understand some of the cultural and religious context that go into the story. So first we'll start with the history, then we'll maybe debunk a couple of things, we'll get into some mystical stuff, some religious stuff, and then we'll do the summary. So first, just a quick timeline of Egypt. I'm actually going to start backwards. I'm going to start from the latest occupation, the British, and go backwards in time, just so people understand how, first of all, just how old Egyptian civilization is, and how recent I would say European, at least in the most recent idea of European and I guess white quote-unquote-ness has been a part of the Egyptian story, so that we can kind of get an idea. So the British occupation, which after that is Egyptian independence, lasts from 1882 to 1952 with some, you know, there's some history like gray area there, but that's for simplicity, that's 1882 to like 1952. Before that is the French occupation. So that's 1798 to 1801. And that's with Napoleon. And I feel like Napoleon felt like Egypt was a little bit of his like white whale. He was like, I shall take over Egypt, because of this idea of Egypt as this grand past empire, and Napoleon seeing himself as an inheritor of the ancient Roman empires of the past, which we'll get to in a second. And this story in particular takes place in between this French occupation and at the beginning of this British occupation. So that's where the story diverges. Then, before the French occupation, was the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire, I would say, is sort of a transitionary empire between sort of like the old caliphate empires, which we'll get to in a second, like the Islamic empires, and the newer, like, modern empires of colonization. The Ottoman Empire kind of walks the line of that just in history. And so it does the same thing here. That's from 1517 to 1867. And then before that, we have sort of like what they call medieval Egypt. And just a reminder to everyone, the medieval times for Europe were a dark age. Not true of the Islamic world. Like, it was the aggressive opposite of a dark age. We've got extensive artistic, cultural, and scientific advancements that span almost 900 years. And like, basically act as a bridge in most like of our knowledge between the Romans and Grecian period to like the quote-unquote modern period. Like, without the Islamic Empire, there is no Renaissance, because a lot of the works from the Romans and the Greeks were interpreted and translated by the Islamic empires and like built upon, and all the scientific, a lot of the scientific and cultural discoveries that we consider to be like the European Enlightenment or the Renaissance time period literally have all of their roots and bases in Islamic translations. Okay, which makes sense because that period lasted from 641 to 1517 when it comes to Egypt and the invasion of Egypt. And there's like a bunch of different empires under that. There's the Abbasid, there's the Mamluk Empire, there's the Umayyad Empire, there's a bunch. I did not even say those in order, but there's a bunch of different waves of empires. And I think another feature that we won't go into but can talk about a little bit is that there were also slave armies is probably the best way to describe it, although it doesn't have the same context of like modern day slavery. So, but because basically a lot of the caliphate empires would kidnap people from different places and then make these kind of armies, and those armies were like had to be loyal to the caliphate, and they also typically would like be given special status and power, although they a lot of times, depending on the empire, weren't allowed to marry until like after a certain amount of time, like after their like 40s or something. So, but over time, those armies just gained political and social power and actually took over. And the Mamluk Empire, which it's mentioned in this book, has a similar trajectory to eventually just kind of taking over the caliphate while starting off as people who were brought in to the empire. Okay, so it's a long, complicated story. You could literally take a class on just one of the empires. In fact, I have. It's a very common thing. So,
which empire was it?
I think we did the Umayyad Caliphate. And yeah, we focused on that one. So going back in time again, before the medieval times. And I think I'm partially doing this because I don't think everyone always knows when things happened when. Like, I think people are just like, I don't know, the Renaissance. By the way, the Renaissance is after the medieval Egypt, just so you guys know. But okay, so before that, or maybe like at the tail end of that, like the 14th century.
So
whatever.
when was the span year-wise, I guess, for medieval Egypt?
Yeah, so 641 AD to 1517 AD.
Okay.
So, okay, now we're going to go back again. And then the Roman Byzantine period is 30 BC to 641 AD. And then right before that, and kind of leading into it, the reason I kind of separated them, because I do think the Greeks are slightly different from the Romans. And I also think the switch from BC to AD is like a big enough switch that you should like leave it in its own section. But before that is the Macedonian Greek period, which starts off with Alexander the Great and his invasion of Egypt in 332 BC to 30 BC. And that ends with Cleopatra. And then, you know, you remember Cleopatra, then you got like Julius Caesar and the Romans and what's that guy, Mark Antony, whatever. So that's so that's what you get that section. And that's where you have this idea of Cleopatra as, you know, an Egyptian queen and this idea that everyone has of Egypt. But get ready for it, because we're about to go even further in time to the ancient Egyptian empire, which goes from 3150 BC to 332 BC and has multiple intermediate, smaller, like
empire timelines inside of that. And that's mm-hmm. when the pyramids were created, like in that long timeline. So just 3,150 BC to 332 BC.
What does that mean?
Yes.
3,000. So just to put that in context,
like the British occupation, the Napoleonic occupation, even the Ottoman, hell, even the Islamic Empire pales in comparison timeline to the length of time where the Egyptian Empire was just that. And of course, that's a simplification because there were lots of smaller regions inside of Egypt that like had internal disagreements and internal conflict. So let's get into it for a second here, because there is this idea of Egypt as not being mm-hmm. African, or the African people not being in Egypt, and the empire is being built by, I don't know, either in some histories, aliens, apparently, and in some histories, which is actually a retcon, there's somehow this idea that the pyramid builders were of, you know, a lighter skin, European ancestry, Aryan ancestry, and they ruled over the darker skinned Egyptian people. And so all those technological advancements were actually from Europeans. And this comes up in the book, right? The brotherhood of Al-Jahiz, one of the characters is looking for the Aryan roots deep inside Egypt, because he's like, they must be there. And that actually has a history of its own, and it comes from colonization. So actually, and the Europeans did this in a lot of places, where they try to do an epistemological erasure and recreation. I mean, it's honestly like a really weird fanfic where they were like, man, India and Egypt and the Middle East all have these like really deep empires and technologies and cultures that are super advanced. Some may say more advanced than us. And some may say that many of our like traditions and ideas come from these older empires, hence why you have a pyramid on your dollar. So what could possibly make that a reality if we also believe in eugenics and that whiteness is superior and we want to establish this as a truth? And they're like, well, I think if we do a lot of finagling and a lot of conspiratorial thinking, we can somehow imagine that actually all the inventions created in the past come from a deep Caucasian Aryan ancestry. And you're like, what is Caucasian? What is Aryan? And they're like, we're making it up. And we can find different little trinkets and things that justify our imagined history that don't hold up to scrutiny and time, but it doesn't matter because we're ruling everything right now. And so you had this whole long idea and misconception of Egyptians as European, or having this deep Aryan European features, that completely disregards, one, its geographical location, two, the amount of the Nubian Empire that existed right next to it, and like all the dark-skinned empires that existed next to it traded with it, and therefore were likely all part of the same like historical, geographic, sociopolitical, cultural context, therefore making Egyptians likely of various races and creeds. Well, first, race doesn't exist back then, most likely, but people having darker skin tones and African features who would be considered Black American today would very well have been a large amount of the population. Although, granted, it does sit in between Northern Africa and the Mediterranean area, so there would be various numbers of people. That also being said, there would be no hierarchy of race, because the idea of race as a concept of distinguishment is a far newer concept. Starting, I mean, you can trace it a little bit, maybe heavily, into the Islamic period. Strongly, where you're going to see it most strongly is the Ottomans, and then into the modern period. So Ottoman, French, and British. But before that, the idea of this would be nonsensical. And the idea of darker skinned Egyptians being the pharaohs of Egypt only makes sense. It's only practical. And the idea of that erasure comes from a very specific time period of British epistemological erasure and colonization. Cool. This is very important because there are themes of race relations inside the story, and the idea of, well, where does this come from? Where does this idea of the history of Egypt come from. So anyway, that's Akko's cultural context, part one. Part two, there is also in the story a talk of mystical creatures and magic, in particular, the djinn. Now, the djinn, it's first, let's do a little bit of the religions in Egypt. I'm not going to go into all of it, but one, you have the three that are mostly important for the story of the ancient Egyptian pantheon. That, you know, I didn't learn a lot about that in just in life, which kind of saddens me. And it's kind of hard to find resources on it. But as you know, you've got Ra, you've got Set, you've got, there's like a whole pantheon that's evolved over time and changed. I mean, it's a 3,000-year-old ancient empire. Like it's changed quite a bit. And then you also have Coptic Christianity, which came around the first century or like 42 years after AD. So that's after Jesus Christ died. You have 42 years, and then you have the establishment of the Coptic Christian church, which would make it probably one of the oldest, if not the oldest. Don't quote me on that. And then, of course, you have Islam, which became the dominant religion starting with the Arabic invasion in 641, which is, quote unquote, the medieval period. So you have a much more ancient, you know, religious like background. Kind of similar to you have like Zoroastrianism underneath sort of Islam in Iran. Like a similar kind of, yes, but whereas Islam does take over as the major dominant religion. And then you also have Coptic Christianity, which has caused both, you know, tolerance and persecution over time. So that's a mixed history that we're not going to get into. You just need to know that they all exist. So then the other big thing, everyone's like, are we going to get to this story? Yes, you will. But don't worry. When you read the book, you'll be very excited that I taught you all this. And that
I'm honestly, I wish we actually had this conversation before I read this fucking first part. But continue.
So now let's get into the djinn. Most people think of the djinn as it has to do with Islam, but it's actually a pre-Islamic mythical creature. And I think another thing people kind of misunderstand about the djinn is that they see them as like either the genie from Aladdin or like demons, which is like what, you know, I think a lot of like modern Christian take on the whole, it's like, oh, this is analogous to demons. And it's like, it's actually more, I would say it's more like elves. I don't think like in Lord of the Rings, I don't think that's entirely accurate either, but in the sense that they're just mythical beings, they're mythical creatures, and they're neither inherently good or bad. And they are shapeshifters. They can be humans, they can be animals, they can be a lot of different things. And their abilities and powers can range, as their motivations can range. They can fall in love, they can follow different religions, which is interesting. They can inspire and cause harm and chaos. They can really do what really they're just they're very similar to people. They just are more powerful and more like they got more powers and stuff. But as it comes to like autonomy and choice and goodness or badness, like that is, it's not like angels were typically seen as just like purely good and following you know God. They're just a more, they're like a different, just a different entity, being, I guess is the right word for it.
Are they like immortal?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I'm pretty sure that it's definitely a longer lifespan than the human.
Fair enough.
But I think they can die. I don't think they're like a forever thing. But I know if someone's like, actually, Akko, they are a forever thing, I will happily take that critique. But I think it's just important to note because in this story, the penultimate important thing, other than kicking out the British before the 50 years in which they took over leading to the modern era, is that Al-Jahiz, who is this mythical character, brought the djinn back and magic, quote unquote, back to the world. And with that magic, like magic from everywhere, you know, like they're talking about in India, they were like, well, there's Islamic magic there, but there's also even older magic from like Hinduism and Buddhism. And then they're like, in the Americas, they had to make magic illegal because the Americas knew they were about to be overthrown.
Right.
And so it's and so in this story, the djinn characters are just contemporaries with humans, and they are causing harm or causing good, or they are basically just a factor to be reckoned with in the story. So understanding a little bit of them as creatures is really important. And it's also really dope because now you're really seeing fantasy novel outside of the Western narrative of orcs and elves and gnomes and with a different mystical creature. That's why I kind of made the comparison. It's like not to make anyone's thing seem like it's not real or is real, but just to show like if we're going to write a story outside of the Western lens, like you have so much stuff to pull from, so much stories and mystical elements that can be reimagined and put into stories. Okay, cool. That is cultural context with Akko.
Wow,
as a note, if I am wrong about anything, please, 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 listeners, tell me and I will most wholeheartedly make a correction in the next one. I have absolutely no issue with that whatsoever. If you're like, Akko, not bad, not bad, kiddo. Like, I'd also like to hear it because I do love validation. But anyway, sorry, Marcy, what were you going to say?
Honestly, well, first of all, thank you. Well, if you, as far as validation, thank you for this cultural context, because I literally did no ass research, just hopped the fuck in. And honestly, I literally thought that djinn were made up. I didn't know that they were like a real, like that was like a real, like,
oh, yeah,
creature. Like that was something that was actually like cited in history. So like, I feel like reading this, I'm like, damn, like, girl, did you even read it? Because like, I feel like there was so much context I didn't have. Like, I mean, even the piece where you were talking about how like when djinn came back, like it was meant to prevent this British imperialism. Like, I didn't make that connection until like damn near the end of part one. I'm like, wait, so the British never took over? And it's like, bitch, where have you been? Did you not read the book? Like, anyway. So thank you for that. Part two is going to be Liddy because we have context. And I'm less... just completely oblivious than I was before. So thank you for that, Akko. Not saying that you did that only for my benefit, but certainly there was a benefit for me. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. I find this fun. Looking at the different histories and the different empires that have existed and the different timelines is really, I find it enjoyable. And also I think the best way to sort of dismantle the epistemological colonization of our minds is to look into history and realize that it has a completely different timeline than we've perhaps been taught. And putting things in order that maybe we weren't given learning in school really helps you sort of put things into context and understand it. When you see it that way, I mean, the idea that there have been Egyptian empires 3,150, I mean, they're contemporaries with the Persian, like that. Remember the one we did with Persepolis? And it was like, Persepolis is like an old, very old empirical city, like, and just remembering that human existence has been that long and that varied and we've had so many empires, it makes you real, like, in the same way you can look at the stars and feel very small, you look at human history and you realize just how small our time period is and how cyclical, you know, human nature is and the things we've done, and you sort of start to see this beautiful, terrible, wonderful pattern of human existence, and you become slightly humbled or not. You're like Napoleon and invade Egypt. So we're gonna take a break. And when we come back, we'll jump into the summary.
Sounds great. See y'all in a bit. And we're back.
Woo!
So I don't know about y'all, but I took the exam after Akko's cultural context, fucked it up, literally got 100. Like, I just feel so equipped. So now let's get into part one of The Master of djinn. By the way, we read up until chapter 16 for anyone that might be reading along. So let's hop right in. So boom. Basically, so the story essentially is kind of like an alternative alternative timeline of Egyptian history. And it kind of takes place sort of starting around like Egypt's late modern period. So basically after Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, which was in, I should know, that ended in the early 1800s, 1801. Mm-hmm. So basically what happened in this timeline is that there was a man slash magician, prophet, inventor, overall bad bitch named Al-Jahiz, who essentially brought djinn back into the world. Djinn, as you all know, are the mystical creatures that Akko was mentioning earlier, brought djinn back into the world as well as magic, and that kind of changed the tide of everything. Now, it's said that Jahiz himself was, he was often described as like a dark-skinned, like Sudanese man. And basically, after he was able to bring magic and like djinn back, and basically was able to sort of disrupt and prevent British colonization, he just kind of like mysteriously disappeared. Like he just like kind of vanished. Different accounts about like who he was and like his whole tea and all that. We'll get into that, whatever. So basically all y'all need to know is that right now the book starts off in the year 1912, and because of the djinn's reemergence, like Egypt was never actually colonized by the British, and so we are just sort of like chilling, sitting pretty. And so because of that, there's sort of this moment of, there's a lot of talk of just like, you know, magic and modernity, and sort of we're kind of in this interesting, like, giving like a little steampunk, like kind of clockwork robotics, like type T's going on in Egypt. You know, independent nation, mama's making advancements in science and technology, politics.
Like, electric trolleys in the sky, and there's like robots, but they're like clockwork robots. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's like really interesting. And there's, you know, even politically, right? Like there's a lot of like talk around like women's rights and like women. I'm not sure if women either currently have the right to vote or are working towards the right to vote.
I think they just got it in the book.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. So that's happening, as well as women taking place in like sort of high political offices. So like, you know, much further than the European counterparts, might I add. But just it's going to Egypt. It's a vibe. Like it's a vibe. TLDR is a vibe in 1912 Egypt. So like basically our protagonist in the story is a woman named Fatma Shawari, who is like the youngest special investigator with this ministry called the Ministry of Alchemy, Enchantments and Supernatural Entities, which is basically, so they're not like they're not the police, but basically they're a department that essentially was created after the djinn kind of came back into the world. They kind of look into like magical things taking place. Like whenever there's any sort of like, you know, magical happenings, they kind of investigate the whole situation. So very like detective tease. Yeah. Fatima, by the way, is one of like, I think, three women like special investigators at this time.
And one of the youngest.
So yeah, she's like in her mid-20s, like 24, 25. Also, by the way, Fatima, just describe her personality. She's like very cool, collected, very much giving you private eye energy.
Yes.
She also has like a fucking amazing sense of style, which we will talk about. But like she always wears like these boiler hats and like these like really colorful suits that are like just very, like very well fitted. She carries around a fucking cane that turns into a sword. So like very like dandy energy. Like it's getting very dandy tease.
Yes.
Which we love to see. And people are like, Fatma, like, not for nothing, like,
it's a mood.
We vibe with the aesthetic, like we fuck with it kind of energy. So basically the book doesn't start off with Fatma. We'll go into what it starts off with in a second, but basically one of the first scenes we see with her is like she's like undercover, she's like on a job right now with like one of her partners, and basically like she's like in this like bar where basically there are like these two boys that have like a djinn in a bottle. And she's trying to like, she's like, you know, she's like undercover. So she's like trying to like buy the bottle off of them. Yep. It's like, this is low-key dangerous. Like, just give me this bottle real quick. And the boys are like, nah, fuck all this. Like, whatever. And like slam the bottle. And basically the djinn like comes out. The djinn's out for blood. And it's like, oh, these two boys have blood that I could enjoy. And so then like Fatma literally has to like lip sync for their lives. And
for their
like,
lives,
hey,
not
djinn,
hers.
Like literally not like, Fatma was chilling. She was like, listen, I could leave now. Right now and like just have lunch. And like, honestly, my life would be totally fine. But so she's trying to like convince the djinn not to like kill them. And the thing is, so we learn here that Jin are really interesting because they are very literal with how mm-hmm. they understand, like with language and stuff. So when you speak to them, you have to speak to them very precisely. You have to say exactly what you mean, like using a bunch of idioms and like being unclear subtext, shit like that. They're like, girl, I'm going off of literally what you told me. So if we make an agreement or a deal, like you need to be very precise in your word choice. Period. And we see here too that Jin are kind of integrated into society as well, right? Like this one was in a bottle, but like Jin are like lawyers, they're librarians, they're just like part mm-hmm. of like the tapestry of society.
Yeah, because this Jin has been in a bottle for like thousands of years, wakes up and was like, honestly, I put myself in this bottle hoping when I open again, y'all would not be around because I do not like humans.
Right.
And Vatim was like, let me do some like exposition for the reader and for you. Actually, Jin and humans now live integrated into society together.
Like she like turned to the camera and was like, I'd like to do some exposition now. And everyone's like, wait, bro, who are you talking to? And she's like, anyway, so just to provide like this, like, yeah, like it's all
simulation. It's like a whole thing anyway.
No, like Fatma literally like knocked on the door of my apartment, like completely broke the fourth wall, like it was wild. Anyway, so basically after Fatma like saves their lives, I guess, because basically she was like, please don't kill them, the gym was like, girl, I guess. There's an investigator named Asim who's part of the police. He's like a mm-hmm. inspector investigator person. He approaches her and is like, hey Fatma, like I want to talk to you because there's a case involving magic that I think you should know about.
Dun, dun, dun.
And basically, she's like, what's the tea? And he was like, aye, so boom. So this is what happened. So there was apparently this secret society called the Hermetic Brotherhood of Al-Jahiz that had about 20 people, and mm-hmm. all of them were found mysteriously murdered. And he's like, I need you, Fatima, to please investigate. And Fatima was like, really interesting way of presenting that case, but I'm down. Fuck it out. Wear it out. So basically, and so this is actually what we see at the very beginning of the book. We yes. saw this happen in real time, actually, this event. And so basically what happened, just to kind of give you all the skinny of it, was mm-hmm. that essentially there is one Lord Alistair Worthington, this like kind of English, essentially Orientalist who lives in Egypt, mm-hmm. who's been there for a number of years. And he has this secret society called the Hermetic Brotherhood of Al-Jahiz. It's yep. mostly a bunch of like other British people who are to varying degrees are interested in the whole Al-Jahiz thing, but basically like their thinking is like, oh, Al-Jahiz, like we need to really look to him as a figure to like, I don't know, guide us for the future. We need to like kind of, I'm not sure if it's like worshiping him or just fetishizing his presence or like what's their goal?
Yeah, I think the best way, so there's Worthington's goal, and I think in cultural context you would see Lord Worthington as part of, so colonization happened in like a lot of, it wasn't like a straight trajectory. So there were a lot of British people who were kind of obsessed with what they called the Orient, which is really Middle East and Africa, and sometimes could include the Eastern world. They had this weird mm-hmm. distinction between the Occident and the Orient, which is a completely made mm-hmm. up distinction that has nothing to do with like anything except for, you know, look, the Europeans thought the world was flat, okay? We can't really turn to them for an accurate description of the world at this time period. So anyway, so, and there was a lot of, some of it could be seen as just like a study and interest in a different place, mm-hmm. but it did, a lot of it got really kind of like fetishization, kind of like, ooh, the Orient, alchemy, and it just got a little bit like mm-hmm. how could we use this magic, and it's, you know, right. The viewpoint now it's
getting
quite
weird.
Paternalistic, right? It's getting weird, and that slowly turned into this like white supremacist tint, which is like, how did right. you go from this like weird fetishization, actually I'm not even gonna say how did you, that's very easy, but like it went from this kind of odd fetishization into this infantilization into this supremacy narrative. And so what right. you see with Worthington is that area in that gray area of someone who has this kind of deep, almost obsessive interest, which society is like, why are you even interested in this area? Because right. we look down on them. So Worthington is like, this will bring us all sorts of enlightenment. And
right.
other people are just like, one guy who's in it is just like looking again for like the quote unquote Aryan roots of the Egyptian empire, which don't exist. And then other people are just there to get close to Worthington because in Britain he's rich. So there's a lot of varying motivations, which would probably be accurate of the time period. Sans the djinn coming back and magic coming back into the world. But anyway, Continue.
Thank you for that context. So, like, all of this is happening within this secret society, right? And basically, yes. So, like, not to drag it, but basically what happened was, well, at the very beginning of the book, we actually were in the mind of this guy named Archibald James Portendorf, who was, like, part of the secret society. Loki mm-hmm. wasn't fucking with anybody. Was nope. like, girl, I'm really just trying to go home for Christmas. Like, fuck out of here with all this shit. But basically was like, I'm, you know, trying to, like, climb up the ladder, whatever.
Yes.
While they're there, whoop, 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 like, the girl's a key king. All of a sudden, boom, out the door comes in this, like, it's like two figures. There's one person in a gold mask, and then there's someone else who's, like, in this, like, black cloak. Who, and the person in the black cloak can actually, like, clone themselves. Mm-hmm. So basically, the person with the gold mask was like, I'm Al Jahiz. Like, y'all, I heard saying, y'all spreading my name in these streets. Y'all know who the fuck right. I am, and I'm back. So this is a chop. Like, y'all gotta get the fuck out of here, like, whatever. And then, like, basically, Lord Worthington is like, please, prove to us that you are Al Jahiz. Like, we do not, we just know better. And then Al Jahiz, like, you know what? I'm gonna stop it right there. Let me demonstrate the shit that I can do. And basically, he set the room on fire, but only internally in the bodies of the people present. Yep. What I mean by that is that basically everyone burned alive, but there was not a single flame or, like, sign of smoke. There was no soot. It was entirely internal. Mm-hmm. And so basically, what Fatima sees when she goes check out the situation, she's like, all these people are burned to death, but, like, there's no fire damage. Like, mm-hmm. how the fuck did this happen? And so she's already like, okay, magic was definitely used, because, like, how the fuck? And then there was like this really annoying guy named Dalton who was, like, racist as fuck. And basically, mm-hmm. even Al Jahiz was like, girl, you gotta go. And so, like, mm-hmm. the person in the black cloak, like, turned.
He turned him inside out. It was wild.
I don't know why I laughed so hard. He turned Dalton's head 180 degrees. So, like, turned it backward.
Yeah, it was like a horror film.
And so that's how he died. And so then Fatma was like, is this bitch's head on backwards? Like, this, what the fuck happened, bro? What happened in this fucking room? Anyway, so it's a lot going on. They're like, girl, what the fuck happened? Meanwhile, there's a woman named Hadia Abdel Hafez, who also is another young woman, Muslim woman who wears a hijab, who, like, comes in. She's like, hey, Fatma. And Fatma's like, who the fuck? And she's like, oh, like, I'm your new partner. Like, I'm Hadia. And Fatma's like, who? And so, to give some context, Hadia is, she's, like, pretty involved with, like, the feminist rights movement in Egypt. She actually lived in the U.S. for a while. She, like, went to the, I guess, the, like, the, like, basically the academy for the, this type of ministry of, what's it called again? The ministry of magic
enchantments.
And enchantments and all that. Everyone's like, what the fuck is this explanation? Anyway, so basically Fatma's like, oh, Hadia, that's really cute. Look at me not being interested, because, girl, I work alone. What you mean? Like, I don't do partnership. I don't do that. I don't do that. But meanwhile, Hadia's like, no, like, you don't understand. Like, I've always wanted to work with you. Boop, boop, boop. And then mm-hmm. Fatma's like, yeah. So basically, the two, like, kind of fake ass start working together, essentially piece together the fact that, yeah, magic was certainly used. And they also thought it was really interesting that they're in the room. There were actually these two idol worshippers. And so when we say idol worshippers, we're talking about people who sort of follow more the ancient Egyptian gods. So, like, your Sets, your Ra's, etc. And so Fatma's like, that's interesting. Like, let's see who these people were. Maybe the folks who are kind of in the same community might provide some context here.
Right.
Also, what happened during this, so there's a lot of moving pieces here. So just, we're going to try to provide some of the details here. Also, while they were there, Fatma and Hadia got to meet Abigail Worthington, who is essentially Alistair Worthington's daughter.
Yes.
And so she mentioned she actually ran into old boy with the gold mask. So that's how Fatma and them found out that it was a guy in a gold mask. And basically Fatma was like, okay, girl, so did Alistair have enemies? Like, what's up? Right. And basically she was like, well, I wouldn't really know that, but my brother Alexander might, because he was actually more involved with, like, sort of the business musings of the Worthington estates. And Fatma's like, interesting. So Fatma goes home. Hadia's like, hey, I'll see you later. Fatma's like, yeah. So Fatma, like, goes to her apartment, and then inside she runs into, so literally inside her apartment, which she runs into, like, her ex boo slash lover named CT, who's, like, Nubian. The two of them, they were, like, they met like a year and some change ago.
And you know, yeah, actually, like, probably importantly to the story, they were working on a different case together where they were trying to find, like, the clock of the world. And there was, like, a... Honestly, they keep mentioning it. You're like, huh, is there a prequel? Because it's, like, a whole story there, and they fell in love.
Right. With, like, an angel. Yeah, they, like, fell in love. And basically, Fatma's like, Siti, what are you doing in my apartment? But, like, don't leave.
Right.
I mean, my bed's over here. Listen. And so they get to... What did Parveen call it? Congressing, perhaps.
Congressing,
a little Congress took place, you know, a little parliamentary action. They was doing anything but filing their taxes. Anywho, the next day, CT is like, look, I did not only come here for a good time, I also wanted to make sure I kind of go to the temple to... So Siti herself actually worships a deity named Hathor, who's like the goddess of like love and beauty. So she's like, I actually came here to like kind of reconnect with like the people, blah, blah, blah. And like Fatima's like, oh, that's perfect. I actually meant to talk to some of the, to go to that exact temple, because that's actually where the two people who were killed in the Al-Jahiz incident, like they're actually from that same temple. So the two of them go, and there Fatma meets a priestess named Marira and another priest named Ahmad. Turns out Ahmad was actually... lovers with one of the people that was killed. Her name was Esther. And so like Ahmad has like is like very invested in like this whole situation. So Fatma's like, okay, look, that's cute, that, you know, relationship charts, cute, woo, but like why the fuck were they there? Like, why are y'all even involved with these motherfuckers? And so basically they were like, okay, so look, basically the Brotherhood of Al-Jahiz approached us, and they were talking about, oh, like we need some, what did they say exactly? They were like, we need some more Nilotic quote-unquote blood in our secret society, and we would love to provide y'all with some money, and blah, 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 blah. And basically the temple people were like, okay, well, that actually could work, because low-key we actually experience a lot of stigma in the society because of our religion, and two, this kind of like, you know, financial backing could actually make we could actually invest this into having a more, you know, public place to worship and things like that. So it was kind of like a, I guess, mutually beneficial type of relationship.
Right. Because just for like to throw it back to the cultural context, right? You have like Coptic Christianity and then after that Islam. And so Islam is the predominant religion of Egypt by the early 20th century. And so the ancient Egyptian religions are like, they're not it's on the back burner of society, even with like stigma and such. So that's what they're right. They're like, it's not like we're getting funding. Like, we had to get the money somewhere.
Right. It's like, we can use these British hoes to get some money. Shit. I mean, shit. But then it all worked out terribly because then two people died.
And you know what? So, this is actually a common story for different groups of people in which the British show up. You're like, I don't know, maybe we'll use them to get what we need in society. And you're like, how did that turn out so poorly? And you're like, just literally put in asterisks the British and you'll like have an answer. Anyway, see, continue.
Very that. So after this, Fatma and CT decide to go on a date. I'm 5 years old. So they go on a date to this like club. It's like this, it's really popping club. You remember when we talked about, oh my god, what was it called?
The Black of the Berry?
That one club.
Yeah, yes. It kind of was giving that vibe.
It was definitely giving that where they were like, there was like live music and like food and shit. It was just a vibe.
It was a vibe.
Yeah, so they go to this popping ass club, and I'm like, girl, why am I not there? They meet these like these musicians from like New Orleans, like, and that's kind of where we learned that like in the U.S. like magic was outlawed and like all this shit.
Ooh. Also, can I like put a slight like side note? Can you imagine how wild it would be to have like magic return to the U.S. because of just how many different cultures are in the U.S.? Like, all of us be bringing our magic. Like, we would have magic from everywhere. Like, honestly, oh my. It would be fascinating.
It would be fascinating. It would be everything. Like, I feel like I would only live. Like, I don't see any potential consequences, which is, like, I mean, probably a very myopic way of looking at it.
There are so many consequences.
Like, I only see joy as the outcome.
But even can you just imagine, like, the change in power structure? Like, you wouldn't, I couldn't even say what would be the result, because there would be so much energy, like,
right,
and that could both like heighten and like destroy each other. Anyway,
I know that's right. Yeah.
All right, back to you.
So anyway, so Fatma and Sita are like, okay, so we just got our lives at the club, fuck it out, wear it out. And so they leave and they feel like someone's like stalking them while they're like walking home. And like, turns out, so they like do a quick 1-2 action, like get that person together. Turns out it's Ahmad. Mm. And Ahmad's like, oh, like I was just, Fatma, I was just making sure that you was doing your job because you over here at the bar. And like, girl, aren't you on investigation? Like, what you mean? And then Fatma's like, are you fucking sick?
Right.
Is it not like 11 p.m.? Like, what? Right. So basically,
she's
Ahmad's like,
can
like,
I not walk and chew gum?
Right. Like, yeah. Both are happening, I guess. And so Ahmad's like, yeah, I actually didn't only come here to enforce arbitrary, like, workplace, like, boundaries, but also I wanted to talk to you because there's actually a lead in this whole situation. Fatma's like, girl, tell me more. So, boom. So basically, Ahmad's like, come with me. I have something I want to show y'all. So he's like taking them to this, like, neighborhood. CT and Fatma don't know what the fuck is going on. Uh-uh. Fatma's like, girl, this bitch might. Might kill us, like, not for nothing. And then CT is like, yes, like, I wouldn't put it past him. And Ahmad's like, I'm in the same vehicle. So they literally were like, just like, openly talking, like, even reading it. I was like, wait, is Ahmad in a different car? Like, I was like, no. Why? Anyway, so basically, Ahmad takes them to this neighborhood where we find it's like this, this poor neighborhood in, I'm not sure if it was even in Cairo. Or like right outside, but basically. Yeah. Then this neighborhood, there's this like giant congregation. So remember how Abigail was like, oh yes, like there was a man in a gold mask. So there's a man in a gold mask. So same guy who claims to be Al-Jahiz and the guy in the black cloak or whatever. Like we see the two of them like in this, you know, in front of this, like, I guess, square of people. And so, like, yep. There's a bunch of people, like, kind of around them. Basically, the guy in the gold mask is like, oh, like, I'm Al-Jahiz. I'm back. We here. Fuck it up. Like, mm-hmm. Boop, 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 boop. And Fatma's like, oh, this is really interesting. And so, basically, Al-Jahiz here, we see this here. We also see this a little bit later. Essentially, he's specifically going to these more, like, neglected, like, poor parts of not even just like Cairo, but just like other just in parts of Egypt. And essentially is kind of raising this message of like, look at all this state and institutional neglect that you all are like experiencing. Like, I, Al-Jahiz, am coming back and I'm going to support you while I'm here for you, the people. Like, you are specifically the people that I brought the djinn and the magic for, like, not these people who are like exploiting you to get richer and shit. So a lot of like kind of class divisions clash, mm-hmm. like class tones mm-hmm. happening here. Basically, so all this is happening. Fatma's like, interesting, interesting. But then Al-Jahiz is like, oh, wait, actually, Fatma, your ass can't be here. And so then all of a sudden, like the one in the black cloak comes over and like clones himself. And like, I keep saying him. I actually don't know the gender of the person in the black cloak. But basically,
they like clone themselves. But you're right. We don't know.
No, Al-Jahiz for sure is the one in the gold mask, but the black cloak I actually
we don't know.
No.
Oh,
yeah. So basically, the one in the black cloak like kind of so they do this like shadow clone moment where they literally like clone themselves and shit. So like basically like they make clones and like it was like basically Fatma and CT versus the shadow clone like cloaked person.
You're
it was
right.
Like this whole battle. And like so it was like this whole like battle was like super intense. The cloak person is like super powerful, but basically like the battle just kind of ends and like they write on this wall like, oh, Al-Jahiz is back. And then Ahmad out of the crowd where he was hiding with everyone else was like, y'all good, that battle looked really
he's like
wild. And Fatma and CT were like, bitch, where were you the whole okay.
That
so,
is like literally me. Like I'm like hiding under a desk. Wow, y'all really did.
Oh
that.
My
wow.
God. Oh my that, did you God. See when they cloned him? Like that was what it's like
that?
Okay, so you literally all these words had no support when the ship was going down. Where
like
were
cleaning
you?
A wound.
Ahmad?
She's like, yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
It's like, great. Thanks, Ahmad, for being fucking useless. Anyway, so like, so this all happens. The next day, Fatma somehow went to work after the club and beefing with these people in these streets. I don't know when the fuck she got. I'm like, girl, you slept for like 2 minutes. Mm. So basically, she goes to work. She sees Hadia, who I guess everyone had kind of forgotten about, her partner, quote unquote. And she's like, oh, like, Hadia, let me tell you about my night. Like, it was wild. And so, like, she, like, kind of gets her caught up. She's, like, warming up to the idea of working with Hadia.
Yes.
She's like, okay, like, I'm not, like, as opposed to this. Because also, too, like, you know, she's like, you know, we are the only women here. Like, you know, we can't be out here wilding. The men will eat that shit up. So they end up going to the library to, like, investigate more about Al-Jahiz. They basically learn the things that I kind of told y'all just now. You know, he's, like, an inventor,
the magician, the avatar, you know.
Yeah, all that shit. So, so they learn all that. While they're there, they meet a shady djinn named Zagros, who's like the librarian. I'm only mentioning him because he will come up later. Mm-hmm. Anywho, so after this, Fadma and Hadia and CT, who I guess also just showed up randomly, basically like are all, they like are together, and they get this clue to go to this place called Seti Hardin, where they need to meet a woman named Nabila Al-Mamser, who's from this like rich, powerful family that like does a lot around like the newspapers and like the press, basically. So a lot of like pull with the press. Because basically there's this, so Nabila herself is like really racist and like terrible. Basically, but what we learn from her is that like, so the day that that whole incident happened with the 20 people, Al-Jahiz burning everybody, Alexander Worthington, who if you remember is the brother of Abigail, so Alistair's son, he contacted Nabila and was like, you have to hide the details of what happened. Like, we don't need people out here wilding. Like, it was already embarrassing that my father was involved in this like weird Al-Jahiz shit. Like, we don't need to know this whole secret society was happening. Like, girl, what the fuck? So not only did he tell her this, but he told her this in person. Mind you, Abigail told Fatma and everybody, like, oh, Alexander wasn't here. Like, he arrived the day after this whole thing happened. So, like, how the fuck is Alexander there the day of talking about, oh, by the way, don't mention this? So it's very strange. Like, what's going on? Was Alexander here or not here? Was he on a boat? Is the tea?
We don't got teleportation. We may got robots. Listen. But we don't got
So
we got some questions. Alexander's story is not adding up. But Fatima's like, okay, you know what? Why don't we go catch the guy in the gold mask, this imposter, and figure out the rest later. So Fatima grabs Asim and his crew. That's the police captain, but not Hadia, who she lies to and says that rookies aren't allowed on missions like this. So Hadia is like literally twiddling her thumbs in the office, being like, "Ah, damn, wish I wasn't a rookie." And Fatima's like, "Do do 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 do," this like lied to her.
Straight up lied to her.
So Fatima and Asim and you know their crew, they roll up on the imposter, quote unquote, who's talking to the crowd, basically saying like, hey, modernity has
left
y'all.
And this is like this is another crowd, by the way. It's not the same. He didn't go back to the same neighborhood. It was like a different neighborhood.
Yes. It's a new neighborhood, new crowd, same mask, same spiel. And he's like, y'all, modernity has left y'all behind.
All the same bullshit. Right.
And he's like making a good point. He's like, look, they've got all these huge buildings. We've got these floating streetcar trams. We've got all these buildings. All this stuff was supposed to help y'all, the people, do better. And it looks like you're just being fed to the capitalist masses. So what's good? And then Fatima jumps in and she's like, you claim to be Al-Jahiz. I don't remember Al-Jahiz being a murderer. And the crowd's like, and Al-Jahiz was like, I don't remember Egypt being full of systematic inequality, racism, and exploitation. And the crowd's like, and so there's like this back and forth where the crowd is like offering colorful commentary. So Fatima will make a point, and then the crowd will be like, actually, I kind of feel Fatima on that. And then Al-Jahiz will hit back with like, well, what about representation for the masses? And they'll be like, yo, period. What about representation for the masses? And so like groups are starting to split up. She's like, well, if you're the real Al-Jahiz, show your face, because the real Al-Jahiz never wore a mask. And everyone's like, yeah, that's true. I remember factually in my textbook that he never wore a mask. And he's like, fine. So he takes off his mask and everyone's like, oh shit, he looks exactly like the textbook said. And Fatima was like, damn. And so now, you know, there are groups having like discussion sections. There's a committee created. People are taking, people are really trying to figure out what's going on.
That's like a PowerPoint presentation. Like, right. Just like...
Some people are honestly packing up their stuff and going home. But what's more importantly is like tensions are rising. You know, people are starting to get a little feisty. The police, obviously not there. First of all, there's not enough of them. They're like, yo, we thought we were just coming for like, honestly, just a little discussion. We didn't think it was going to be a whole, we got tensions rising over here. And the people are like, yeah, we're getting more and more irritated. And the police are like, we're freaked out. And Fatima's like, yo, Asim, calm your crew. Like, we're trying to get this sorted. Obviously, nothing gets sorted. Tensions keep rising. And a brawl just breaks out. And in the midst of the chaos, you know, Al-Jahiz and that the person in the cloak, they're coming for Fatima. Luckily, though,
okay, for Fatima, Hadia rolls up and is like, oh, what? And Fatima was like, hey, Hadia, what are you doing here in the chaos? And she's like, hey, Fatima, there are no rules about rookies not being allowed to go on missions. And Fatima was like, ooh, cool. Ooh, good point. Ooh, and she's like, clink, 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 still fighting with her sword. Clink, clink, clink. And Hadia was like, why would you lie to me? And Fatima was like, can we clink, 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 do this another time? Clink, clink, clink. All of a sudden, Siti shows up, of course, at True Blue True. She comes in and she starts throwing hands. Everyone's outnumbered. Right. Everyone's confused. It's basically the definition of a dumpster fire, but everyone manages to escape. The next day, Hadia's just putting it up. Yeah, what's up?
I was gonna say real quick, so the battle was wild as fuck, but something that did happen that was interesting was that like more police showed up at the end, and basically Al-Jahiz, the one in the black cloak, they like summoned in an Ifrit, which is like this creature, fiery djinn that came in, and the Ifrit had like a literally like a saddle like on its back, and they like rode the Ifrit like into into like not the sunset because
the
of
horizon,
time, but, like, into,
yeah,
right, the horizon basically, and everyone saw it. So with everyone seeing that, Fatma's like, yeah, so this gonna be on Front Street in like 2 minutes. Like the rumor mill is about to be bussing. Like it's about to be jumping up in here. Nobody's gonna not know about this shit.
Right.
It, like 2 days from now. So
like in the chaos was also like five journalists who were like, just made my bread and butter for the year. Like they're
like,
taking
look at rent being paid for the next 8 years. Look at God.
Fact. And we should also mention there was like Al-Jahiz like pulls out this like singing mystical sword and basically is like, by the way, this sword sings to you right before it ends your life. And you're like, well, that seems kind of, you know, a little bit, I don't know, showy. Like, is it really necessary to sing?
Right,
but anyway, it's a magical sword.
Okay,
yeah, I mean, this really, it doesn't really add anything to the equation. But the Ifrit part was far more impressive and really the part everyone took note of. But there was this little sword side plot. But so anyway, as Marcy points out,
the swords reading the book, like, damn, like, I really feel like my part was really undermined in that section. I just feel like I played a bigger role, but okay.
Right. It's like, I even sang, like, I really, anyway. So, sword aside, Hadid and Fatima meet up the next day. You know, Fatima's going to the gym. We see Hadia there, and she's like, kind of, she's dueling with one of those, like, they call them, like, automata eunuchs. Basically, but they're like robot people. They're like, but they're made out of clockwork. So Hadia's dueling with one of them. Fatima rolls up, and like the tension is thicker than the sword fight that they're having. Like it's filling the whole air. Fatima's like, hey, and Hadia's like, oh yeah, now you want to talk? And Fatima's like, look. And then Hadia's like, look, I went to the academy. Why won't you take me along? Do you think I'm just some like pretty princess girl who can't fight like Siti? And like Fatima's like, that's really not me and Siti's relationship. It's actually way more cosmically. And Hadia's like, I don't care. I have this whole speech that I prepared about how I want to be your partner and I'm ready for this and I trained and you don't think I'm capable, but I am capable. And Fatima literally goes, did you prepare that speech? And Hadia's like, yes, I did. And Fatima was like, okay.
And Hadia like crumbles up her paper, like throws it hurriedly to the side, and is like, that's not the fucking point. Like, I expected this from the men here, but damn, Fatima, like, your ass is doing this too? Yikes.
And Fatima's like, yeah, you're right. And I'm sorry. And she's like, it's really more about me just not wanting a partner and wanting to honestly keep other people safe. And Hadia's like, don't need to keep me safe. I can protect myself. As you saw from when I saved your life. And Fatima was like, cool, good call. You know, point taken. So while they're having this heart-to-heart, society has decided that it doesn't have time for heart-to-hearts. It's just got a story to tell. So the presses are going wild. Newspapers, everyone's got it covered. The big ones, the small ones, the tabloids. Everybody's talking about the brotherhood. Also, Tea Lady, the racist one from before, she's like, sips tea, gets out of her tea bath. It's like, I think we need to stop hiding the story about the brotherhood right now. It's like, wait, aren't you just adding to like the proverbial
literally
chaos?
Literally adding to the mess.
And she's like, literally drops the tea and is like, guess I am. So that story comes out and everyone's like, whoa. everything that Al-Jahi said yesterday in that little, you know, tennis match between him and Fatima yesterday is correct. Like, the murder was of, like, a bunch of British people who were trying to, like, subjugate the British again using some ancient power that they may or may not have made up in their own minds during their little brotherhood cult thingy. And they're like, mm-hmm. I don't know, he's got a magical sword, he's riding on an ifrit, he's right, maybe this guy is Al-Jahiz. So there's basically it's getting complicated, and the government's like, hey everyone, I see that Al-Jahiz may be back, and I do see that that's causing, you know, maybe a social reckoning that we weren't expecting, but we were planning on having a summit to show the rest of the world how stable and not reckoning we are, so everyone could just simmer for like the rest of the year. That would be great, and the rest of society right.
just
literally
like shut the fuck up for a little bit, like just let us look cute. That's all, and we can really do this later.
Right. And the society like literally turned their newspaper for half a second and continued reading. But during that time, Adia and Fatima, they receive a letter from Alexander Worthington, and he's asking them to meet, basically. So they meet up with him, and he is exactly what you expect. He's a colonialist, misogynist jerk who's basically like, my father was a fool for getting involved with this Al-Jahiz business, and now we all look like fools on my island. He's like, I want to forget everything about Egypt. I'm taking all our money. I'm taking our what's worth of our Worthington name, which is worthless. Anyway, so he's like, we're getting out of Egypt, and Abigail, you're coming with me. And Fatima and Hadi are like, man, like your boy is pressed, and he's like, whatever. And they're like, look, were you in the special society with your dad? Like, do you know what happened that night? We talked to the tea lady, and she told us that, honestly, I'm calling her the tea lady because she's kind of racist, and I don't really want to talk about her that much, but she's the news, the one who runs the newspaper. But and she told us that you told her in person to stop the article the day of the attacks, which means you were here before you said you were. And Alexander's like,
so what
whatever.
Fuck, Alexander.
Yeah, come on, make it make sense. And Alexander's like, look, I was on the boat. Check my records. Just check the people who were with me. I don't know anything about this. And honestly, I don't care. You're dismissed. And they're like, well, that was a worthless meeting that got us nowhere. But luckily, Abigail comes down and she's like, look, my brother is a jerk, but I do have some documents, like a little accounting book that was owned by my dad, is the accounts for the Brotherhood, so maybe you can make sense of it. Fatima's like, honestly, I can't read English that well, so especially not handwritten English. So Hadia's like, flip page. Oh, she's like, this isn't just an accounting book. Like, there's commentary on the side here, and it mentions this djinn named Siva, and also mentions that the Brotherhood was paying 50K. They paid on two separate occasions, they paid 50K to Siwa. And they're like, whoa, that's a lot of money. And they're like, for what? And Hadia's like, dun, 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 a sword. And they're like, so we find out that Siwa lives in the Red Road District. So Hadia and Fatima, you know, they call an electric tram or whatever, and they get in. They're off. They go to the Red Road District.
How the fuck they get?
Right. However, but they get over there. They meet up with Siwa. Get ready. This is about to get kind of wild. So Siwa is this djinn, and inside, yeah, it's kind of cool, but it gets really freaky. So they go inside, and it's kind of like a weird psychedelic experience. Like, they get inside, and the room is bigger on the inside than the outside. Like, the different pottery and, like, different things on the wall are changing color and shape and elements. And, like, so Hadia's looking at a teacup that's brass, and then it turns to copper, and you're like, what is happening? So Fatima starts talking to Siwa, and she's like, look, do you work with the Brotherhood? Are you in the Brotherhood? And Siwa's like, yeah, I'm not part of the Brotherhood. Like, that was a pretty weird organization. No one with any sense was in the Brotherhood. And you're like, oh, wow. Okay. Tell us how you really feel.
Pretty strong opinion. You got a scathing review there.
Right. Like, they gave you 50K. So then Fatima tried to ask about, like, Right. Like, you really came for them. But so Fatima tried to act about Alexander, and all of a sudden Siwa starts reciting poetry and speaking nonsense and tries to cut out his own tongue. And Hadia and Fatima are like, what is... They're like, look, we knew. They're like, we knew it was going to get weird, but this has gotten kind of wild.
And like, the room starts like, it's like the walls are made of like, right, like it's like, it's almost like they're made of water. Like, they start just like whoosh, like kind of undulating back and forth and shit. They're like, girl, let's get the fuck out of here.
Right. They literally are like, this is our cue to leave. So they step out and honestly handle it very calmly. Hadi and Fatima are like, what in God's green earth was that? And then Fatima's like, oh, they were like, we should have seen it. It's an illusion, Jin. Like, the whole place was an illusion. And Hadi's like, of course, we should have known when it was bigger on the inside than the outside. And because everything just kept changing elemental, like, properties, which is clear indication that this is definitely something wild. So they're like, okay, someone must have put a curse on the Jin so that if he ever tried to reveal the secret, this, whatever that was, would happen. And they're like, but who would be powerful enough to curse a Jin? And they're also like, okay, this is not making any sense entirely. But then they remember that there were these kind of mechanical golden camels, and he had like a lot of them. So basically, these new mechanical camels are like an invention that's come about with like the djinn and the architecture, whatever. And they've made camel racing very popular in Cairo. And they realize, oh, Siwa has like a gambling addiction where he bets on these like mechanical camel races, and the 50,000 that he got from the Brotherhood in exchange for the sword was to feed his gambling addiction. Hence why in the accounting book, it's like, we're not going to support his addiction anymore. Okay. So they're like, the pieces are coming together, they say, as they get back into their electric tram or their car. And they're like, we got to head back to the ministry, the tavern, what's
horse,
happening?
Whatever.
Right. But then suddenly they're like, wait a second. They're like, there's a sandstorm happening. You're like, a sandstorm? Well, this isn't the time or the season for a sandstorm in Cairo. And then Fatima's like, good call, Akko. This isn't the time or the season for a sandstorm in Cairo. And they're like, and also, Hadia's like, I can't tell the direction the sand's going, which I typically am able to do. And they're like, that's because the sandstorm is only over the ministry. And they're like, oh, no. So Hadi and Fatima, they're running to the ministry. They get in there and they're like, what is going on? Like, the internal like electric system is broken. The defenses are down. What's going on? Suddenly Fatima's like, oh crap, there's ghouls. Like, everything's been infested by ghouls. And basically in the story, like, ghouls are kind of these like mystical, magical creatures. They're like kind of evil. I guess they're like zombie-esque without like having to eat people's brains. And when you cut off a piece of them, it like turns into dark smoke and just like evaporates. So the ghouls are just have infested the whole.
Real quick, the one in the black cloak, so whenever Al-Jahiz has like the one in the black cloak like next to him, like, they think that that's a ghoul as well, actually. Of like how they clone and the ash piece that you mentioned just now. So just want to mention that, because I'm sure that'll come up against
it's
later.
Part two. I think you're right. Good call. Good call, Marcy. So they're like, we think everyone's been trapped inside the ministry because there's ghouls everywhere. So they're like, all right, let's kind of try and figure out. So Hadia and Fatima team up. They grab some other people, Onsi and Hamed, who we didn't mention, but they're part of the ministry. And they're like, all right, time to take care of business. So they're trying to take out the ghouls. And they managed to. They're like doing a really good job. They save everyone. However, they're not out of the woods yet, because it turns out the masked figure is in the building and he's going towards the vault.
Oh my God.
I know. So the wild thing is, inside the vault is the clock of the worlds from Fatima's last mission with CT that they kind of mentioned in passing about, you know, it was wild, there was angels, there was all sorts of stuff happening. Yeah. We don't know. We Akko and Marcy also don't know what happened in that story, but we could tell you now, it was intense. So Fatima's like, we gotta go. If they're going to the vault, we gotta stop them. And like, I think Hamed's like, well, don't worry about it. Like, the vault's under security. She's like, the ghouls have taken over the security system. So they're running to figure out what to do. And they get to the library, and Zagros, the librarian from earlier, the shady one, who was actually, while shady, was actually like well-intentioned and kind of had a soft spot for Fatima, has been turned against her. Yep. And he starts attacking her, and Fatima is literally fighting for her life. And while that's happening, the imposter is like slowly packing up the bag full of the clock of the world pieces and plans. He's like examining something. He's like, oh, interesting. A recipe for cake. Let me put that in there too. He's like, oh, I did want to leave the book on accounting. Yeah, let me just put put that in there. Meanwhile, like the cloaked figure is like, we don't have a lot of time for this. And then the masked man's like, don't worry, she's distracted. Meanwhile, in the background, like Fatima's like clink clink clink, trying to like block Zargos's
like,
attack,
hurling herself against fucking bookshelves and shit, like just like screaming and shit. Like she ran down with these other agents that got like knocked out hella quick. Like quickly. Their HP went to zero almost immediately. Yes. And like. Yeah, so.
It's like when you're doing like a team battle and it's just you with the team on your back and you're like, I have like right. 3 HP like little hearts left, I'm not gonna make it. Anyway, she manages to get through it, but right when that she manages to defeat Zargos, there's like a bomb that goes off and destroys half of the ministry building, and the imposter like Slig, just in a bag, you know, with the rest of everybody else, grabs the pieces right. of the world, the clock of the world, and the plans, and he just skedaddles. And so Fatima's like, this is not good. The clock of the world could literally destroy the world. Dun, dun, dun. And that's really part one.
Yeah, that's that. So let's take a quick break, and then when we'll come back, we'll get into all of our thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
Back.
Yeah.
Yes. So now we will get into the nitty and gritty. So overall impressions of the book. So I really like this book so far. It is like, I'll be honest, it took me a little bit to get into it. Like the first like 50 or so pages, I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm really like, this is fine. And then page 51 happened. Nothing specific on page 51, but just something clicked and I was like, oh, we fuck with this. Like, oh, I'm seeing kind of the through line here. I'm seeing how this is coming together. And the audience is like, aren't you the same one that was like, you didn't realize that in this world, Egypt was even independent until like way late? And I'm like, that is also correct. However, my interest in the story came much before that realization. And so there's a number of things I really like about this book. So first of all, I feel like as far as like the writing of the book, like it is like very descriptive. Like yes. I love the descriptions and a lot of like kind of architectural sort of like structural descriptions that I feel like I don't know. I'm not sure if like most authors that I typically read kind of have that level of description for like buildings and shit. But like I found that like a lot of the, you can very much tell that like Pagelli's a historian, just based kind of on, or just yes. sort of the minutiae of like some of the details that like he'll describe. So like I found that like really, really interesting. I feel like as far as our characters, like, well, first, before we even get into our main character, I liked that, like, so the book's kind of like what I mentioned earlier, the book actually didn't start off from Fatima's point of view at all. It was actually from Archibald's point of view. So I kind of went in thinking like, oh, Archibald's gonna be like the main character, like we're gonna just see what happens, like whoop, whoop, whoop. And then when like he died at the end of chapter one, I was like, what? And then they're like, oh yeah, so like now hard pivot to talking about Fatima. But I was like, what? So I kind of liked that like fake out moment. This is a very like esoteric reference, but it kind of reminded me, oh, actually this is a major spoiler. If anyone plays the Danganronpa series, there's a game in that series that does something similar where you're like baited to think that someone's the protagonist, but they're actually not the protagonist. And it was kind of like a similar moment of like, oh wow, like I did not see that coming. Granted, I unlike Danganronpa, I love who the protagonist became instead. And so I thought that was a really great intro, really gripping, really very much like kind of got you into the story.
Yeah.
And there's just a lot here as far as like the texture of the characters in the world. Honestly, I feel like this book is like casually hilarious.
Yes,
like it's like,
I agree.
There's a lot of just small things that you could just tell a lot of care went into the world. So for example, like when we were talking about how like earlier when Ahmad like was in that battle with CT and Fatma and just conveniently like found his way out when shit was getting gravy, and then came back and was like, oh my god, like are y'all okay? And it was like, girl, like the book very much made you realize that. Her part, like the police inspector, he has like this mustache, and like instead of talking, sometimes he'll just twitch his mustache, and that's supposed to like convey meaning, like or like fucking, I don't know, there's like a guard who like works at the ministry, and like every time Fatma sees him, he's like, she's like, bro, like his his uniform is like hella big, like he really should go to a tailor, like this is a mess. Or like Abigail, whenever she like enters a scene, she like speaks like horrendous Arabic, like the shit yes. makes no sense. Like it's just, there's so many just fun little things, details yeah. that I'm just like, it's just, it's such a fun, it's like it's exciting and like the stakes are high, but it's also like, I don't know, kind of just like fun. You like the characters are just like having fun. There's like a lot of humor in the book that also just makes it really, really nice to read as well. So
agreed.
Those are just kind of my like kind of overall thoughts and impressions. But yeah, Akka, what did you think?
Yeah, I echo pretty much everything you're saying. First, I mean, it's talking about Northern African architecture. And if you want to see examples of that, you can just like type in El Andalus or Northern African architecture. And you're going to see like just what is so gorgeous about this architecture and why it's described with such depth and beauty. And I agree. I enjoyed so much about this book. First, like kind of as I hinted to earlier, the idea of like a fantasy, I guess it's like a steampunky novel set outside of the Western lens. Ah, chef's fucking kiss. I mean, just yes. to build this whole world, taking historical facts. And like I said, there's so much of like lore from the world to pull from. And the author just brilliantly kind of weaves it all together. And I just love this global African and Black conversation. Like the people from New Orleans, they come in, they're having a conversation about jazz in the early 20th century, but still discussing, you know, the racial like difficulties of the day that they're saying even in Egypt. And he just weaves that in so right. brilliantly, this sort of conversation. It's and everything. I just love the care that the author took in writing this world. I think he is meticulous in his construction of this world. He's meticulous. You can see kind of the steampunky influence. You can you feel very immersed in the world. And it does mm-hmm. have a slower start when you begin, but you like when you kind of, I think what flips the coin for you is when you finally like see the world you're in, and all of a sudden it yeah. feels very tangible, and it feels like a very tangible place in a tangible world. Even as Marcy pointed out, even if you don't actually understand the historical context that's happening, like the author writes a really tangible world, and then when you put in historical context, you start to have this really fun experience of a retcon story, of a story of Egypt that decenters the European lens and the decolonization story, because there's it kind of intersects the history at a different point in time. And that's so fun to read. It's so much fun. And then, Marcy, to your point about the characters, absolutely. He writes his characters with so much care and depth. They're not perfect characters. They're not unrealistic characters. They're just characters. They're just people. Fatima is this sort of dry wit, funny person who's like actually like a little bit awkward when you get down to it, you know, like yeah. Siti is this kind of gorgeous, loving, lovely, dangerous goddess character. I mean, it's brilliant. Hadia is this like low-key badass, and you get this kind of Sherlock Watson vibes from Fatima and Hadia that I just simply love, you know. It you really kind of get this dynamic duo story that is so much fun to play with. And of course the trope of like I'm a detective and I work alone, like that's a trope, but the way that they use that trope and weave it into story is so much fun. I mean, y'all, it's just a fun detective mystery novel. And like I think one of the things that I want to see more in the world is just a fun, interesting take on a story from a different perspective, and that's exactly what this is. And I like literally could not ask for more. Like,
yeah.
So I fucking dig this story.
No, I highly agree. I love everything you just said. And to your point, I you know, one thing that I really love about, well, there's a number of things. Well, first, yes, totally agree with everything. As far as like just the duo of like Hadia and Fatima, but also like kind of including CT, like sometimes like I really like the combat scenes in this book, which is usually not something that I notice or like even call much attention to, but like there's just such a like the stakes are just it's not even like I'm like, oh my god, like everyone's gonna die, but it's just it's so like you're kind of like at the edge of your seat. Like, I don't know. I'm just like very like, agreed. Oh shit, what's about to happen? Like, okay, oh shit. Like, he's pulled out that sword. Like, was gonna happen. I don't know. I feel, it makes me feel like it makes me think a lot about like, you know, playing like, you know, Japanese role playing games and like, mm-hmm. kind of like fighting the big bad boss and like things like that. Like, I just find the fight scenes really interesting, and it's also just nice to see, especially like in the scene, you know, when we saw like Fatma and like CT kind of fighting together. Like, I love this like queer like women of color duo like coming together, taking names, fucking it up. Like, I love that. Like, I was like living for those scenes so much. Like, it was just like so fun.
And each of them has their own like strengths and weaknesses, like Siti and Hadi and Fatma, that it just plays so well. You, unlike, okay, I love Kingdom of Souls still, but still, like, the fight scenes in this, they feel like he plotted it out very carefully. And
there's a
reason for each fight scene. It's, you know, like the first fight scene, you establish like the stakes of the socioeconomic disparities between the groups and how that influence is Al-Jahi's able to influence those the different groups of people. And the second fight scene, you not only see that, but you also see sort of the governmental state, the police, is like not for the people. And you see just like what Al-Jahi's is talking about, and the idea of like the colonization and people wanting to move away from that. And basically everyone has a motive. Each fight scene pushes the story forward and gives the characters more motivation and gives them more depth. You're like, I get what Al-Jahi's is talking about. Like, Akko and Marcy over here sitting in the crowd being like, now Al-Jahi's is making some good points over here. And then,
hey, listen, points were made. Like,
that's what up. And then I see him sitting there and he's like, well, what about the points that Fatima made? And you're like, you know, she did make some good points. You know what I mean? You're sitting there getting the motivations of each character, which gives depth. And it's not just a fight scene for fighting's sake. And I think that's really impressive. Right. Anyway,
yeah,
I cut you off.
No, you're totally good. And I totally agree. I actually thought a lot about Kingdom of Souls and just how, like, one thing that I really, and again, that book is so, it is such a strange relationship I have with that book. But like, one thing that, to your point, one thing that I really did enjoy about this book is that honestly, in a lot of the fight scenes, I mean, even when they're like rolling deep, like, they're kind of entering a losing battle. Like, oftentimes, I mean, like, they're either outnumbered, outclassed, shit, all of the above. It just completely at a disadvantage. And so, like, half the time, the objective isn't even, like, how do like, defeat the enemy? It's, like, how do we survive? Like, when Zagros was, like, running after Fatma, she was like, listen, I just need to live. I just need to survive this battle at this point. Because if I die, then, like, chow, ain't nothing happening with Al-Jahi's. Because I'm dead. The fuck? It's just very like. Agreed. So, and I think that also just makes for a more like compelling, interesting story where it's just like, damn, like, how are y'all going to come together and uniquely use your strengths and weaknesses to kind of like strategically come up with the best way of like fighting this battle? Like, Fatma, for example, going back to the Zagro situation, like when she was in that library, she was like, she literally had to use the placement of the bookshelves, the placement of tables, like, and all this other shit to kind of like contort a situation where she could like get in one blow, because she knew she couldn't attack head on. So she was like, how can I use the environment to my advantage? And I find that type of strategy way more interesting than, like, I don't know, like summoning the biggest weapon or the biggest whatever and then just like taking out the enemy like full sweep, you know?
Or
so
just
like,
having like a strange magical power that makes you stronger than everybody.
Exactly. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's just like, or like you're just like 12 people taking on like 500 motherfuckers in like winning unscathed and like literally like deities like bringing like beasts out of the sky that were never mentioned before. We love you, Kingdom of Souls. We love you. But when the army of ninjas showed up I think they were assassins. Like, they like came out of nowhere and then like Rujik and them just like defeated everybody. I'm like, how? Okay, y'all. Okay. Okay. Cut. Stop. How the fuck did that just happen? But like, anyway, so this book is not giving that at all, which we love.
I agree. And I think to your point, just to like jump off of that too, is like, you don't have to have everything for a battle to have stakes. You don't have to be the most powerful for a battle to have stakes. What you need is a disparity in power, right? Which is what, you know, this is why you love an underdog story. You need some type of disparity, which means a character can't be overpowered because there's no disparity. You need some type of stakes, something that makes it, to be honest, a lot of those fight scenes, kind of jumping off your point, weren't even really about the fight, right? Like, Fatima did not come to any of those situations to fight Al-Jahi's. values. Typically, she was like, in the second one, she was like, I'm just trying to turn public opinion against him and to get him to cop to these murders. Like, so right. It's because there's something else at stake and different motivation, you see strategy come out because the fight isn't necessarily the point, which is, it's just adds nuance and context that makes just the story more interesting. I also wanted to add, the Jin element is just really rad in the story. Like, not to take away from the actual like religious belief about Jin and the mystical belief, but in this story, as sort of characters in the story, it really, really adds something to have characters that aren't human with their own motivations and power dynamics and effects on humanity. It changes similarly, and again, I don't mean to be dismissive, in Lord of the Rings, the fact that you have other characters with the human population and there's that dynamic of power and imbalance just adds a texture to the story that makes it far more interesting. And the Jin do the same thing here. And then also, the level playing field that's created by the introduction of magic, and so that, like, basically Europeans, non-Europeans, people of Egyptian Arabic descent and people of like Egyptian Nubian descent or darker descent, like the playing field which it hadn't before becomes so much more level, even though they do talk about like disparities in wealth and how that runs around across race lines. But that's exactly it, like the story with the reappearance of Al-Jahiz disrupts that social hierarchy, which is what we live in right now. And I think that is the point the author was trying to make, is to kind of throw everything back into chaos and like reimagine. And it's just, and to have this through the lens of like this kind of ragtag team, Fatima, who is like Egyptian with a lot of like what we'd say would sub-Saharan African features, which I think the racist tea lady mentions. And then Siti, who's just she's like, I am just a dark-skinned Egyptian woman. And then Hadia, who is like, I think she would classify herself as much lighter skin, Arabic descent, not really having a lot of sub-Saharan African features. And having them all kind of together to show like Egypt as this place of multiple different people and ethnicities and types, and what that looks like outside of the 20th century congealing of race categories, which I know people don't realize this, but the 20th century, the mid 20th century, is really where racism and categories of race congeal. Like, obviously there's a through line way into the past, but if you really want to see where it becomes hard and fast and true, I think the 20th century very much creates the present idea that we have. Again, I know obviously, and the enslavement of people and Jim Crow and all these things are much older stories, but I'm just saying, like, the lack of gray area comes with, I think, the rise of the British. I would say that's very true. So seeing that interceded, like, right when it's about to happen, is just so fun and interesting. Anyway, okay, that's me.
I love everything you just said. I, to respond to the Jin piece first, I totally agree. I feel one thing I really liked about the Jin was that, like, it did not, I thought the story might be an allegory about, like, okay, humans are like people are like on top, and then like Jin are like being subjugated or like whatever. And like, it, like, I feel like sometimes we'll see these stories where it's like there's people, and then there's the introduction of something of a species that's like people, but like different from them in some way. And like, it becomes this kind of whole like people versus this group, right? And like, and then it kind of becomes like the allegory of like racism is sort of lost. And like, oh, see how, like, I don't know, and this is no shade, but like, you know, I'm thinking about, for example, like Origins, for example, right? And like, in like the Broken Earth trilogy, right? And like, how it was kind of like that intergroup sort of situation kind of became the allegory for racism versus in this story. It's I like that it was like, oh, but like racism also just exists between people. Like genocide, like, it's like all of these dynamics are happening. Like, there's like this whole like global imperialism moment where like, and then like, you know, nations fighting back, and like all of this is happening. And Jin are also just being introduced to just like kind of add some more seasoning to what's already going on, you know, like, and that's what I loved that piece, that it didn't take away, and that like it kind of allowed for there to be like just to add more layers, not to replace
Yes.
Or become a metaphor for a dynamic that clearly already exists between people. So,
oh, I love that.
That was something I definitely really appreciated, because I feel like oftentimes fantasy can tend to, can tend to replace or kind of make metaphors of things that are just always just, that are already very real.
And then not address them, to your point. Really address them. Oh, Marcy, such a good point.
Yeah. So thank you. So definitely loved that. I also just loved the talk about this idea of modernity and what Al-Jahiz represents. What's interesting is that I know we were saying earlier, we were like, oh yeah, I mean shit. Al-Jahiz, listen, when he had a point, he had a point. Not gonna sit here and act like Al-Jahiz was just saying bullshit. It was, it's inconvenient for the state, a Fatima and a Asim, people who kind of are working with those state interests. But it's interesting seeing. I like that the writing allows the reader to really to see that, right? Because I think sometimes we'll see stories where if not a police officer or someone of a similar kind of state space or kind of carrying along those state interests, and when we are introduced to a character like this, they're made to seem radical and absurd, and you're supposed to sympathize with the state, versus in this book, it's Fatma herself is
right.
Not wrong. Points are being made. And so I think I love this question of in the introduction of magic, in this idea of we were going down a certain timeline. We have the balance of power has shifted. Things are much more level. Modernity. But, what are we doing with this idea?
Ooh,
does this make sense in this context? Where should we move next? And this question of how should we go about that? I find that piece really, really fascinating. And I do think that if not, I mean, Al-Jahiz certainly, some of the methods here are very extreme, but I think if you subtract the violence, I think the philosophical question that is being asked is a very interesting one, because it's what does it mean to be in a world where magic is being reintroduced? So you have djinn, you have all these ghouls and shit, but people are still living in poverty. People are still being neglected by the state when there's clearly an abundance of resources to go around. What does that mean? Can magic not also be introduced into our own institutional practices and the realities that we all live, that we create for ourselves, right? The way we relate to one another along class lines, race lines, etc.
Right. So, which is why that throwaway line of America just being magic is illegal. The fact that they're we don't even, whatever social equity this would cause, whatever resources this would allow us to redistribute, make it all legal.
Right.
Right. And it says so much about the human character, right? That it's kind of like when we're reading Dread Nation and you're like, I believe that this would happen. I believe that y'all would still try the slavery stuff, even with there being zombies.
When it makes no sense, right?
When it makes no sense, you see here and you're like, I can see this playing out with magic still being hoarded by the state and used for the benefit of the most powerful, when in actuality, it's supposed to be something that levels the playing field. I mean, the point of alchemy is that you can literally turn wheat into gold. There are no lack of resources if you can magic up gold. But still, and to your point, Fatima, the government has an invested interest in keeping these things. And with her first kind of dispute with the two boys, she's like, look, they could give us this money, but we call the gym, we might get we might get gold. So it's this calculation, right? And I think it has a really good parallel with what happens when a new power source, in this case it's magic, but in other cases it is imperialism, or the introduction of the gun trade or some new technology, that disruption in any civilization's whatever trajectory causes a change in trajectory, and it's not a clean change. And in retrospect, we might all make it seem clean and seem like this was the only way it could have gone, but there's so much gray area in between, which is really interesting to look at. And I also really enjoyed in the story that Fatima kind of has to appeal to the people. To your point earlier that you touched on, typically you bring in a character like this and they're right because they're right. Of course they're on the right side. Fatima's a detective. The detective's right. But in this story, when she's sitting in the crowd, even she's I need to appeal to the masses. The Cairo, the people of Cairo are a character
in and of themselves. They're a collective character. And she knows she's from the city. She knows that they have a characteristic, like, you know, like it's a cultural characteristic. What do you say to make a group of people listen to your appeal? And it gave such a tangible feeling to people. And it felt very, I don't want to say like POC, but it did. There felt something very community based about it. And like that it's not just about the individual or the government or this top down idea of who's right. Yeah, it's like almost like arguing in a barber. Honestly, that's why it felt like when you go over and the aunties are just arguing about like everyone has an opinion about the politics of the day. You know, like it was relatable and it was well written. I cannot stress how much I dig this book right now. Like I really dig it. But
is this a series?
I think so.
Okay. Good to know. Good to know. Because, yeah, certainly, I hope it's kind of like a Parveen mystery situation where this does end conclusively, but, like, there's just more
to
in
it.
The universe that's happening. But each one is kind of its own standalone, but,
agreed.
Like, just kind of adds more to the previous. But, yeah, because if this shit is, if it ends on a cliffhanger, I'm going to be low-key mad. but to your point, though,
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm like really excited, but I also am like really excited that it's like three female leads who are just so fleshed out. Like, I cannot stress enough how fleshed out these characters are. I so dig it. Anyway, continue.
Yeah. No, I'm really glad you said that because this is definitely one of those moments where I'm like, look at a man writing women characters in a way that actually just makes fucking sense. Look at this actually just making sense and like is human. Like they just and if anything there's a lot of commentary of like how men just do the weirdest shit. Like there was one moment where like so when they were going to like that second neighborhood and like Fatima like lied to Hadi and was like, oh girl, don't come, like you're a rookie, like whoop whoop whoop. Like Fatima was like in the car with like these like men who like police officers and they like at one point pulled out their weapons and they were like, yeah, we have our weapons, like woo, and then they started like beating their chest and just being weird as fuck. And then Fatima like I think the line was like Fatima for perhaps the 100th time just thought to herself how strange men were. It was just very like there were just moments like that, or like, you know, she would talk like she talked about how like, you know, when she wasn't fucking with Hadia at first and like the director of the ministry basically was like, look, you gotta work with Hadia because we're trying to have more women in the ministry and we want to show we're so progressive, and like boop, 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 boop. Like it's clearly a publicity stunt,
right?
Like Fatima also noticed how like different men in the office would be like, oh, so like you and Hadia, like what's going on? Like are y'all getting along? And like Fatma's like, not y'all gossiping, like are y'all serious right now? Like it's just very, I love just like there's a lot of subversion of like sort of these gendered stereotypes.
Yes.
And also like there's just like to your point, very much a lot of care that goes into these women characters, and like it's gender certainly comes up as far as like the reality of what's going on at work and like the things that they're facing, but it's also like It's just so seamless, and I'm like, damn.
It's just realistic.
Yeah, it's just realistic, and I'm like, okay, so other main authors that are not
right
doing that.
What's good?
What's happening? Because we got a case study right here that is just doing the damn thing.
And this is not to echo what past Akko said when we read, I think it was the Dandelion Kingdom series, Kingdom of...
Oh my, yeah.
The Grace of Kings.
Grace of Kings?
Yes.
There we go.
We got there. And then,
yeah, we got it.
There's like a point where the author is like, I'm going to talk about how women should have rights. And you're like, why don't you just write women having rights? And not rights, is agency. And he's like, we really should have women with agency in this story. And you're like, you're the author. Put it in there.
Right.
This is the perfect example of show, not tell, while still addressing the fact that sexism is a thing. And it's like, you can showcase that sexism is real without making like the actual structure of your book sexist.
Right. Exactly.
Not coming for Grace of Kings, also a great author. Continue.
Yeah, but you know, certainly some issues there. But like, I'm so glad you said that, because one thing I also loved about this piece too, and I think this kind of goes back to the combat pieces earlier, is that there's just like an undeniable strength in The Power of Women that's just like very casually laid in. This is true from not only this book, but I feel like I've seen this in you know, video games that I play, like other forms of media. And I feel like, like, for example, like when we see like Hadia like in the neighborhood battle, just like taking people out left and right, or like when they're fighting ghouls, or like when they're going toe to toe with like Al-Jahiz, and Al-Jahiz is like, chow, I'm about to, right. I gotta do, where am I, Ifrit at? I'm about to get my ass whooped by Siti, because Siti is literally not gonna stop until I'm out. Like, it's just, I love how it's just like, as a reader, as someone experiencing this media, it's just, it's undeniable. It's so casually laid in that it's like, you know, there's so many gender stereotypes around like women being weak and shit like that. And it's just like, when you read like these types of narratives, it just, it points to, like, I don't know, I feel like this is the type of like schema building type of media that I just want to see more in the world, right? Where like where our kind of latent beliefs about groups of people are like just dismantled, laid with these types of foundations. It's just it's the very casual introduction there. So yeah, definitely really, really appreciate that.
Oh, I love your point. Exactly. It's just a cat, and it's because that's the reality, is that people are complex and humans have complex personalities and different strengths. And like, the human experience is antithetical to stereotypes just by simply writing the human experience. Like, if you just write people, you dismantle stereotypes. And I think people try to fight fire with fire a little with stereotypes. And they're like, because a stereotype exists, I'm going to work super hard against it. You're like, no, because a stereotype exists, write a person and that will do the work for you. Unless you've internalized it, which then would make it very difficult to write that kind of character. But I also think, to your, this is something I always want people to understand. No one, in no time in history, has the strongest person always won. That's just not true. Why? Because there's a lot of ways to win something. That's what you call strategy. And it's been the truth forever. It's true when two men are fighting. It's true when any group of other genders are fighting each other. It's always been true. So this fallacy that we have, that people who are like the most quote unquote like bodybuilding, lifting strongest are going to win a fight, and therefore women are just innately weaker because of like some whatever genetic makeup, is just, has always been inaccurate, right? There's that's never how a fight has worked or will work, or how society, a battle quote unquote works. We literally, that is why strategy is a thing. If strongest was the reason people won, we would look, are we stronger than gorillas? Are we stronger than tigers? There's a lot of creatures that humans are not stronger or faster than, and we managed to take over the planet, much to everyone's chagrin. And why is that? And everybody says it. It's because humans have the power of communication, of like working together, of creating tools, of being innovative and imaginative. And that doesn't stop happening when you're having a fight between two people. So just, I think that that's a really kind of harmful idea of things that, and people use as like since antiquity, and that's the justification, and it's just never been true. So totally agree with your point, Marcy. Just thought I would add a metaphor about tigers and leopards just to really stick it to the audience. Do you have like a prediction?
Yes, so I always appreciate a metaphor about tigers. I, as far as like predictions and stuff, honestly, I mean, I don't know. I feel like the whole Al-Jahiz plot, like, I feel like they're going to like stop Al-Jahiz, but I'm hoping they do take like, I hope this is a cultural moment of reckoning with like, okay, what did Al-Jahiz present as like philosophy, like ideas that maybe we can like not fully follow to the T, but like, you know, at least have inform kind of our ideas of like how to move forward, like kind of going back to the modernity piece, like, you know, with the reintroduction of magic and stuff, especially within like, I mean, that was what, like fucking like 20, 30 years ago, you know, like, it's certainly really early after that period. So maybe we can use this to kind of like pivot in some ways to like create a more egalitarian society. On a personal level, I don't know why. I feel like Siti's gonna die.
No.
I like don't want that to be true, but I just get this feeling in my bones that it's going to happen, and I really don't want it to, because basically there was a moment when like Siti was fighting Al-Jahiz where like he had like stabbed her, so she was kind of out for the count, and then Fatma was like, you got me full circle fucked up. So she starts charging to him, and then he, before she even did that, he like noticed like how she was reacting. He was like, huh, This idol worshiper, she's important to you. Interesting. I'll save. And I was like,
oh no.
Oh honey, I hope that wasn't. I hope this isn't a Death Note moment. Please don't write her name down in that damn book. Anyway, so Marcy, really hoping that doesn't happen. But that was just a very minor detail that I'm hoping means nothing, and nothing happens. But but yes, that's kind of what I'm thinking. We'll see.
I'm so mad that you said that, because I think you're right. I'm so upset. Yeah. I didn't even think about that piece. I was like, well, flip page. Like, okay. I was going to say that I think even if they defeat Al-Jaiz, I think something's going to happen where, like, somehow everyone has, like, the, you know, like, there's some disbursement of his power if he is defeated. I don't know if I don't know if Al-Jaiz is like, you know, plus one or negative one on the scale of like net good or evil, you know. I'm not sure. And I don't even know if it's like just Alexander somehow pulling the strings, because, you know, we still got some suspicions about that. I'm not sure. So I don't know. I'm willing to just like go along for the ride, but I do think that if Al-Jaiz is defeated, it won't really be a complete defeat. It'll be like a you know, so there's that. That's really all the predictions. I think Alexander's evil. I think he's got something.
Oh, he's up. Girl. Oh my god. Come on. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just assume that's assumed at this point. Like
facts. I think what? I'm trying to figure how right, it's just facts. The sky is blue and Alexander is definitely evil. I kind of want to see how Ahmed plays into the story. I would be interested to see if Abigail somehow turns it around and like becomes like capital B villain. I could see that happening too.
I could also see that happening.
Right, because she's the one who gave them the book that led them to Siwa. And I wonder if she kind of knew what she was doing and Alexander is sort of underestimating her. So that would be a fun little right? Let's see what happens.
I would not be surprised at all, actually, because Abigail, she real
slick. I could even see her like turning around and being speaking perfect Arabic and everyone being like, huh? And
she's literally
like, yeah, like she was like, I was just, you know, playing the part. I could see it. I could see it. So,
and she was really involved with her dad in the secret society and stuff. I feel like she's downplaying how involved she was.
Agreed.
She was like, oh, like I'm a woman, like no women were involved, which like is that, I mean, there weren't many, it was like one woman involved, right. But like I feel like, I mean, she was with her dad in Egypt for like a number of years before, you know, Alexander and anyone
even
else came.
Showed up.
I don't know. I feel like it's something. And also whenever they go to the Worthington estate, they're always here. It sounds like someone's like banging something or like clasping iron against something. It's like there's like this like banging noise that like will happen. Fatma will notice it and it just stops. So Abigail is definitely hiding something. It's a that whole family. Take the investigate they asses for real, 'cause like it's giving
right,
y'all are
something...
all complicit, like
we got questions.
I feel like Abigail the final boss, actually, after this conversation. Like
that's what
I wouldn't
feeling.
Be surprised if they're like Abigail's literally the final boss,
because also if we like really take into account sort of I think the author's understanding of sort of the world and the roles that women have been put into, if you take this sort of European female character whose society has given this sort of quote unquote not intelligent sort of ditzy trait to and knowing that women actually are not as ditzy as people make us out to be, but rather is she playing into that characteristic knowing how European men work to sort of get the power she needs to do what she wants to do, you know, like it's very possible or not we don't know. That's a prediction.
I mean, I can see that even when they were interacting with Alexander, she was like, you know, crying and things like that. And I'm like, I feel like Abigail could easily.
Yep.
She could. I mean, I feel like, to your point, I think she's very much like, these men think they doing something. But it's me in the driver's seat up in this motherfucker.
Facts. So, and like, that is the history of the world, y'all. Women, that is the history of the world. Anyway, do you have a quote?
Yes. So, for my quote, so Fatma's aesthetic, y'all, I cannot say this enough, amazing. I'm like, Fatma, I know you're like about 100 years my senior, but like I'm gonna need us to go thrifting because chow, I feel like I can learn a lot from your sense of style. So I just wanted to describe like one of Fatma's like outfits in this like scene where basically this is kind of like earlier on. Fatma's like interacting with Hadia, you know, still not really fully convinced that this is like a good idea or whatever.
Right.
So the paragraph basically, this is what the paragraph reads. So it says, Fatma realized she hadn't asked Hadia to come in, just sort of demanded it. That was rude, but it spoke to how rattled she was. She'd made up her mind to come in this morning. She'd even opted for a sensible suit, blue with a maroon tie and sturdy brown shoes. Playing the dandy would have to wait. Well, except for the gold tie pin and matching cufflinks, not to mention the boiler and cane, did the violent pinstripe shirt count as dandy? And I'm like, listen, I hate this description because I love it so much. Like, like, why do I want that outfit on my body immediately? Like, I love this. So very much just like, yeah, like that just kind of gives a quick description. She's, yeah, very like bright suits with these just, oh God. Yeah. So like, that's just like one of many wonderful descriptions of like Fatma's outfits that I just thought was very fun. So
she just...
I'm sure there was something much more like philosophical and like deep, but I was like, fashion. Let's talk about that one. What about you, Akko? Did you have a quote?
I didn't, but I also agree that Fatima's style just makes me happy. So,
yes. Well.
Well, I think that, I mean, honestly, look, read this book. We really like it. We enjoy it. We're having a good time. And if you guys want to tell us more about how you feel about our description of this book, if you want to, you know, do a light but gentle course correction on some of our historical contexts, that would be wonderful. If you're like, just have various thoughts about this very dope steampunky book, love to hear. If you have suggestions for books that we might like, if we like this one, hey, you know what?
Ooh, yes.
At The Color Pages on Twitter and Instagram, These Color Pages, or check out our email at thesecolorpages@gmail.com. Oh, I forgot to mention, you know what we also have? A website. You want to see our collabs? You know, we just did a collab with SJW. We just did with one with your favorite book, with Malavika. Yo, check it out on our website. Check them out, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And if this show brought you any love, light, delight, yes, feel free to leave us some love wherever you are listening to this podcast. So that could be an Apple Podcast Moment, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud. Actually, I don't think we own SoundCloud. Everywhere else, leave us some love wherever you're listening to the show. Also, if you know of anyone in your life that would just, you know, really benefit from a conversation of the reintroduction of magic to really just like really disrupt like British imperialism. If you know someone that like lives for that or shit, even just dandy outfit descriptions or like whatever the fuck you gather from this, or I'm just dead. Us saying mad, whatever brought you joy. If you're like, listen, there's someone in my life that needs this, send them this episode, that's send them up. The link, no context, just send the link and then literally just throw your phone off of somebody's roof, throw it into ongoing traffic, throw your phone into a volcano, and then just move to space, because all of that action is really going to help us to grow in all the ways we need to. I'm sure y'all are like, how? And I'm like, listen, the episode's long enough. We don't have time to explain all that shit. And yeah, so very much do all those things. We definitely appreciate that because it helps our community to become even more colorful. And next time, we're going to get into the rest of this phenomenal, just phenomenal book. Watch us get to part two and be like, bro, the book started off hella strong and like, yikes. So like, I mean, I'm kidding. It's going to be sickening. I can't wait.
Yeah, we hope. We're excited.
So yeah, so we're going to do that for next time. But between now and then, Akko, is there anything else we should leave our listeners with before we head out?
Nah, just until next time, remember to
stay colorful.